And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and also the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. You can listen on the homepage and you can watch the various annoying sliders and various incredibly funny and disturbing memes that I have placed on the website for your viewing pleasure. Bear in mind, of course, ladies and gentlemen, this is a listener-supported broadcast that does not survive without your support, clearly. So if you would be so kind as to go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and start making a regular donation of $5 a month to support the operation, that would be really lovely indeed. American Freedom Radio is also in a spot of bother after being off the air for so long, and they do need a significant amount of funding as well. Hopefully there are people out there who the New World Order hasn't stolen all their money off yet, so they can give some financing to the resistance. Vive la resistance. And my very special guest coming at me from the Uber Kingdom, as I've dubbed it, is Gordon Bowden. Gordon, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vinny. Nice to be on your show.
Being unfamiliar with you, I usually am not with all of my guests anyway, because often when you're researching people, there's nobody that's better poised to explain themselves than themselves. So, if you wouldn't mind, tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
64 years of age, ex-Royal Air Force Gentech GSE engineer, ex-mining engineer. I work for Goldfields of South Africa. 10 years as a facilities engineer in Eastern Cape in South Africa, and recently returned, returned back to the UK in October 2005. Done a few jobs, basically just to survive, waiting for my military pension. That's me. And then I've just been a corporate fraud researcher for much of the last 14 years.
Well,
basically.
And in terms of exposing corruption and the government and so on and so forth, as is the usual stock for the show, considering you've got quite an illustrious career and extraordinary expertise, I gather you're one of those really hated researchers who basically you can't pick holes in your argument sort of thing because you've done your homework. Is that about right?
No, that's about right, because what I've done is I've used forensic evidence, which is basically the evidence that you could use in a court of law, being corporate companies, house documents, director check, and the finances, and the historical history, the biographies of those directors and their company's history, albeit financially collapsed or running for 10 years. Without producing, in my expertise, I cover oil, gas, and mining companies that are registered on the Australian Stock Exchange, Toronto Stock Exchange, and the alternative investment market in the United Kingdom, better known as a casino for organized crime, fraud, theft, and money laundering.
Under the US Stock Exchange, I think in the Dow Jones, you can come in, and if you're listed on that stock exchange, you don't have to file transaction receipts to explain where your money comes from if you make deposits over $10,000. So apparently Coke and Pepsi and a number of other major US corporations have been implicated in major worldwide multi-billion dollar money laundering schemes for massive drug dealers.
That's right. That's right. The same that happens with companies like Vodafone and the big petroleum corporations and mining corporations is that they have an ability to move vast amount of money to subsidiary companies outside of the jurisdiction of the Financial Services Authority, and that is basically corporate espionage.
Could you explain exactly what corporate espionage is for the unlearned?
Well, that's where there's a public listed company where the directors conspire to steal the cash and the shares of that public listed company.
Well,
and they can move it. Yeah, they can move it by using conduits, as in subsidiaries or joint venture partners anywhere in the world, and then by way of a loan to the subsidiary, where the directors of the parental company are also directors of the subsidiary or joint venture partner, and by doing so, what they can then do is write it off. Hence, the money goes out to the parental company. They then class it as a write-off, and that's the end of the story. Money gone.
Is this not a wait. This is very different from how they launder money through charities and what have you. What was it, the Rockefeller Foundation or something of that nature? Apparently, the family just pours shockingly large amounts of money into it, and it comes out clean, almost tax-free.
That's right. But one of the examples that I gave with a charity was, maybe the listeners in Australia and New Zealand would recall the Ant and Dec, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of There, in Australia, Run in the Jungle. Anybody, do you recognize that ITV program here in the UK?
Doesn't ring a bell. I'm sorry, I'm only 30.
Well, it's an annual celebrity contest where they put people in the jungle, and they get given terrible diets to eat, and that's their challenges, insects and grubs, and living very sparse conditions. And when the celebrities choose to get out of it, they just say, I'm a celebrity, get me out of there. And that's a program that's run by two top UK representatives, and they are called Ant and Dec. Now, what I found out was that 16 pence of every phone call for voters who wish to get a celebrity out of the contest would go to a charity called Malaria No More United Kingdom. And within there, I found out some of the directors were Elizabeth Murdoch. Do you know that name?
The Murdoch sounds familiar.
Yeah, well, it's the daughter.
Ah, and does the apple fall far from the tree? I think not.
Yeah, so there were a lot of disgruntled people, because the other person that I found out was a director of the company was a lady that worked for the news network, News of the World, which was disbanded.
Weren't they hacking people's... Tapping. Yeah, they were hacking everybody's phones and everything. It was a big scandal a year or two ago.
Yes, that's correct. So with my ability uncovering fake oil, gas and mining companies, what I also found by accident, one of the gentlemen was involved in a separate case that I was investigating, was a guy called Kevin Cahill. And Kevin Cahill was part of the Comic Relief. Maybe a different Kevin Cahill. But it just seemed quite strange that the people that I was following or researching of the same name came up as Kevin Cahill of Comic Relief, you know, the Red Nose Day. And I'm sure that a lot of the charities, you know, that use these platforms for moving vast amount of money, there's very little financial auditing checks on charities. And this is where I believe a lot of hundreds of millions of pounds are silted through undisclosed accounts and moved all over the world.
My philosophy is basically, if you want to steal money, call your organization something that people would never think steals money. Like, we'll call ourselves a charity, or we'll call ourselves a trust, or we'll yes. call ourselves the Inland Revenue Department, or we'll... Or we'll call ourselves the Law Society, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right. But as I said, that back in 2001, while I was resident in South Africa, I took up a case of my partner, who had lost her life savings in a capital venture scam, and then by recovering the documents on the suspects myself, along with two attorneys of law, and thereafter the South African police services, I started to uncover the dirty side of a billion-pound organized crime, because it involved very senior intelligence service operators of the South African old apartheid regime who were working in conjunction with intelligence services and SAS commanders in the United Kingdom as part of the transcontinental money laundering mechanisms to move the money to the United Kingdom and then divvy it up into in cash and then redistribute it by way of sending it back to South Africa or Australia. I found the total mechanisms and the mechanics of massive billion-pound organized crime. And that took me about 2 to 3 years to be able to use my ability as an engineer to understand the mechanics and the mechanisms that they were using, and then see that they used the same modus operandi time and time again.
Did you have some kind of like Kundalini awakening, some real nasty kind of shock, like, oh my God, this is reality now?
Well, exactly, because when I worked closely with the police services, I happened to see a few files, and I spoke to the inspector that was handling the case, and I just mentioned that in the one file there was a mention of one of the suspects entertaining, wining and dining Sir Mark Thatcher and Lady Thatcher in the Carlton Hotel in Johannesburg, and he was one of the main suspects. So, as I said, now we were talking about, this was shortly before the Equatorial Guinea coup, and I would have said that some of the 130 million that was estimated in my partner's fraud, not that it was hers totally, she only lost $50,000, but there were over 800 victims, and when you added it up, the police reckoned it was over 130 million, and that was just from South Africa alone. What the total was worldwide, I've got no idea. So we were talking about the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, her son being wined and dined by the major suspect in a massive fraud case.
Hmm. Or business partner in the preferred nomenclature.
Yes, well, you know, that's hearsay, but
I don't know. In my opinion, as a journalist, the more cynical you are, the more you tend to be correct. You know, yeah. I mean, yeah. Who was it? There was an old State Department employee who said, "It doesn't matter how paranoid or conspiracy minded you are, everything the government is doing is far worse than you could ever possibly imagine."
Well, as I said, the greatest shock to me was when I found out, because the case was handed over following a failure for civil recovery, was then handed over to the top of the South African police. And through my investigations and the recovery of documents and individuals, what they call an ITC search on background employment of those suspects, I found out that the very head of the Scorpion South African police, who was handling that case, was also a co-director in a fake mining company in the Democratic Republic of the Congo with the main suspects. So we had the top of the South African police, head of operations, involved with the main suspects who should have been conducting the investigation in the crime. And yes, my faith to the police services in South Africa fell through the floor. And then we came back to the United Kingdom after having a telephone threat to say, "You're stepping on some very sensitive toes." And we came back in October 2005 back to the UK, where I've carried on exposing fake oil, gas and mining companies that steal billions.
I'm starting to wonder here. They've got the ability, are these people tied with the banking sector at all? The people who can they can create money out of nothing. And I'm just wondering exactly what the need is to steal money if they can create it.
Well, the easiest way to write off vast amount of money, like the banks, like Royal Bank of Scotland, they went from being in the black to billions in the red in the space of 2 years, 18 months, I think it was, 80, 90 billion pounds in the red from being in the black. And what I found out is that by recovering the corporate documents on these virtual oil, gas and mining companies, was that a lot of them had RBS as the banking sector for those companies. And by looking at the debt facility that was being lent to those fake companies...
Gordon, I'm sorry. Yeah. We're just coming to break right now. We'll be right back just in a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's a listener-supported broadcast. Please go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and donate or start making a regular monthly gift today. We'll be right back after the break with Gordon Bowden. Don't you go anywhere, folks. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Gordon Bowden. Gordon, I hope you held that thought. Please continue.
Yes, very few people understand the structuring of loans from a bank by way of purchasing bulk shares in virtual oil, gas and mining companies. And what they would then do is sell shares to their clients or invite clients by way of mail or email request to say that they have within their investment portfolio departments access to shares for these companies, which are nothing more than shell companies. And then because these shares are in penny stock, which means they carry a very high risk factor, as people are always warned, the shares can go up, the shares can go down, or they can lose their shares altogether. But very few investors in these fake companies would do the research to understand that they are nothing more than massive Ponzi scams. And I've uncovered in excess of over 1,300 on the alternative investment market, which are dual-listed. Many are dual-listed in Australia and the Canadian Capital Venture, which is TSX, Toronto Stock Exchange. And these companies are nothing more than transcontinental money laundering shell companies.
Who's are they connected with organized crime? I mean, violence, cover-ups, that sort of thing, government corruption?
Of course. Because in Australia, in earlier on in 2015, in February, the Australian Federal Police raided the premises, business and residential premises, of a gentleman called Tony Sage. That's Anthony William Paul Sage, Tony Sage, with his Cape Lambert Iron Pty Limited. And Mr. Sage was running multiple other shell companies, which were dual listed and had joint venture partners on the English AIM London Stock Exchange. And they would use those companies to move vast amount of money and borrow and loan, which is nothing more. These companies are nothing to do with oil, gas and mining. They are just vehicles for moving vast amount of money, which are the raised capital from floating public shares to little tiny investors and from selling bulk shares to banks. And the banks, when these shares are written off, they just put the totals down as toxic debt. And this is where my greatest concerns are for the economy of the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, is that very few people would have done the research to understand how the mechanics work. And it's very simple. Once you identify the common directors and how many companies that they financially destroy, by moving the money of the raised capital of those companies to subsidiaries all over the world, which are outside of the financial services authorities of each country, is that the money gets silted away into accounts in the British Virgin Islands, Panama, Gibraltar, Cyprus, Channel Islands. And then, say, there's no due diligence. These people are running industrial organized crime. And it's quite simple when you understand who they are and what they're doing.
It's patent recognition. That's one of the things humans are capable of doing much better than a lot of other species. And in my assessment, I mean, so far, the universe seems to be structured on a thing called fractal scumbaggery, which means if you look at a fractal, it's a hologram, so you can zoom in and keep zooming in, and the hologram pattern will just keep repeating itself and repeating itself infinitely. And the same is true of scumbaggery. If you look into any instance of scumbaggery, whether it be crime or theft or rape or murder or something of that nature on a large, large scale, you see the same methodologies, the same organizations, the same people, and the same money, and the same connections involved.
That's right.
And the deeper you look, you keep seeing them again and again and again in an infinite scumbaggery loop.
Exactly. And when you find, as I did back in 2001, the central boiler rooms where they were in some of the addresses in London, there were over 260,000 shell companies which had links to BAE Systems and arms trading with Iraq and Iran, and also to George Bush's fraternity. And that was through Mohammed Adnan Khashoggi, who then was advisor of a company called Barrick Gold Corporation with the Bushes. So, yeah, the links were all there. It was just finding the repetitive boiler rooms that were central to the money laundering. And once I found those, all I did was I focused on the companies, up to 250,000 shell companies operating out of obscure addresses with dirty, disheveled blinds on the front of them, by identifying those through Google Maps satellite, was to say, how can you have this corporate building, which has got over 260,000 companies that have moved in and out of it, and some over, say, 50,000 still active, where there's nobody actually in the building, if you look through the slanted blinds. Do you understand that?
Yeah.
Is that where are the police? Where are the financial services authority? Where are the lawyers? Well, they're all taking a cut.
I was going to say, you know, they're on the take. That's where they are. Right. You know, they're at the banquet table, eating the small child with an apple in its mouth.
Exactly. I'm glad somebody else is on the same platform, because, you know, when I speak to standard policemen who walk the beat, it goes over their head that they can understand that industrial organized crime on this scale is being allowed to happen in the cradle of humanity, the United Kingdom. Actually, this is one of the worst corrupt places I've ever seen in my life.
I think Thomas Paine once said something to the effect of the common man is handicapped by the fact that a conspiracy is so monstrous that he simply cannot believe that it's happening.
Well, unfortunately, I don't like to be labeled within the conspiracy theory bracket, because that brings a lot of ridicule. However, as I said, I've only based my research on corporate evidence, which is the financial records, the corporate structuring, the company directorship lists, director history, and that's not hearsay, that's fact, as opposed to hearing it second hand. What I've done is I've made up a complete library of every company that I've investigated and done the proper biography of the directors and the company to show. They're actually quite stupid, really, because what they've done is that they've actually published their own prosecution material and the routing and conduiting of the money that they've stolen.
Hubris. It's been around for a long, long time.
It's just that we need somebody of honor and integrity to take these people to pieces.
Well, fearlessness would also be one thing that's absolutely necessary, but more to the point, going up against people like this, they'll kind of take everything from you in the process. especially if you're very successful at it. And when we talk about conspiracy, there's actually laws against conspiracy, right? So they obviously exist. Are there laws against leprechauns? No? That's because they don't exist! All right? So one thing that's actually starting to irk me a little bit is I see credible journalists, incredible researchers, and people of sound mind, sound judgment, uncovering things that literally are conspiracies, the Latin meaning breathing together, as opposed to respiration, which is breathing on your own. And what they do is they avoid trying to look like a conspiracy theorist. But guess what? Because you're exposing a conspiracy, you get called one anyway, no matter how credible your information is. And well, you only get called that by idiots who haven't looked at the information, or by scumbags who are actually implicated in the scumbaggery.
Well, they have to carry a door-slamming mechanism, which is their one of their protective shells. And what I found was by researching some of the corporate addresses of these virtual oil, gas, and mining companies, that some of them had the audacity to list out of Masonic lodges.
Now, well, there
that
you
in
go.
Itself, yeah, that in itself is a protective screen.
Did you lodge a complaint? Did you?
Oh, thank you very much. No. I just catalog them and put them in my archive libraries. But then I confront them by virtue of listing these companies to various media outlets like the BBC, where I was asked to go and do an address to an audience on the steps of Trafalgar Square. Where I outlined some of the addresses in Finchley Road in London. And then we onward marched to the BBC headquarters, where I was invited in through the police barricades and the riot police screen that they'd put around the front doors of the BBC headquarters.
Did it make you feel like an executive?
Oh, no. I said I've met many great people in my military career and working for the University of Transkei. I met Nelson Mandela about 8 times. I was invited to his house. I mean, I've met some truly amazing people. Met the Kennedy family while I was at the university. Pick Borter, P.W. Borter, F.W. de Klerk. I used to, because of my late wife, was in the executive dining room. I used to also, because I was a firearm holder and a marksman, sometimes they used to ask me to do security work while working the bar, if you understand. So I met these people and say some of them were really good people, and I believe Nelson Mandela was one of the truly honorable people that I ever met, but I think he was sold out.
Yeah, back when my brother was a waiter, he actually got the opportunity to serve in Nelson, and they were having some problems in the kitchen, and so brother comes out, he goes, "Mr. Mandela, I'm very sorry, we're having a delay with the kitchen, would you like some more bread and water?" Mr. Mandela looks up at him and he goes, "After 20 years on Robben Island, I think I've had enough bread and water."
Yeah, well, his home was in a place called Kunu, which was just outside Umtata on the way to East London. And very honourable and dignified man. He had his own private doctor, a blonde-haired lady, who looked after him like it was like her father. She was truly an amazing doctor. But he only drank bottled water. He wasn't an alcohol drinker. But his entourage, including his security, would down pints of brandy, so carrying machine guns. So quite a dangerous place to be.
Well, South Africa, as far as I know, and I'm married to a South African, so I've heard a lot of stories. That place is freaking dangerous, and not just the mango worms.
Yeah, well, I say at the University of Transkei, which was in the Eastern Cape, I used to fish regularly on the coast. I had a Land Rover station wagon, and I used to go on my own and fish at night. I never felt threatened, but I always carried a firearm because you were an easy target. There were some Contour, Seasway, and Apler factions still around there. They used to grow a lot of marijuana in vast tracts of land in the forests. And if you stumbled across those when you were driving through, they were all armed with AK-47s. And theirs was a multi-million pound operation. And they wouldn't hesitate to get rid of you.
Yeah, yeah. I think a friend of mine pulled into a gas station, started having a conversation with the guy behind the counter, a South African guy. And he asked him, so why'd you move to New Zealand? And he goes, well, it's pretty simple. Whenever my wife had to go out to get her hair dyed, I had to hire a driver, a limousine, a bulletproof one, and also a few guards with some MP4 submachine guns. And that's just so she can go get her nails or her hair done. In New Zealand, I just gave her a couple of dollars and she just goes down to the shop. It's great, mate.
Yeah. Well, I lived there for 20-odd years, so I think I can stand above a lot of the politicians in the United Kingdom and give a good overview of poverty in Africa, because I saw it all, and including the AIDS epidemic. But the people that I met, even within the mining fraternity for Goldfields of South Africa, they treated me like their brother, and trust me, the guys that I work with, they would die for you, and I would have died for them. That's the sort of environment that you have within the mining industry.
Well, let's take a moment then. We're coming to break just about now. Ladies and gentlemen, my very special guest is Gordon Bowden, coming as live from the United Kingdom, and we shall be right back at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Don't you go anywhere, folks. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 4 days a week. We've just gone through the daylight savings, and that's nice. It's great. I actually wake up earlier in the morning now. It's unbelievable. And also, that means because we're on the opposite side of the planet, those of you in New Zealand who actually want to listen to the show has been backdated by an hour. So instead of 3 till 5 p.m., it's now 2 till 4 p.m., Tuesday through Friday. And in the United States, it is 9 till 11 Central Time, Monday through Thursday. That's 10 till midnight Eastern, and 7 till 9 p.m. Pacific. I hope you all tune in live to those broadcasts. Now, back to my guest, Gordon Bowden. Now, I'm getting an impression here, right? There's a giant system, okay? And all systems that I've noted in my career thus far have an end goal. I mean, sure, they've all got a point, and sure, they've all got processes, but every device that is created for a purpose to achieve a certain goal. Do you know what the goal of this organization you're talking about, this massive interconnected web? Do you know what the real goal is?
I think it's just a syndicate of top elite who use a system which is a virtual system, whereby they acquire at very low cost what they call distressed assets, and by that is historically abandoned care and maintenance, flooded piles of junk, and then use those to facilitate billion-pound organized crime and conduct insider trading. So using these, what I've uncovered just in the United Kingdom, in excess of 1,300 fake companies, where they can work with their cohorts in Australia and Canada, and then conduct their own organized crime system. And using these conduits, they then fund certain political parties and their leadership. And I include George Bush and Bill Clinton, because some of my records of the corporates on the Toronto Stock Exchange include a gentleman called Frank Giustra, who was who gave a donation of $31 million to the re-election campaign of Bill Clinton. Now, that money came from the corporate entities on the Toronto Stock Exchange, which were the very same companies that I have made public and I aver are nothing more than virtual companies. Because when you trace them and trace their assets, which are listed within the corporations, is that you find that these are nothing more than mining claims bought for a few dollars on the premise that they will go into production in 200 million years' time. But these are what they call the jam tomorrow people, who use their expertise, which has been gleaned and groomed over 20 to 30 years, to procure vast amount of money by floating shares on public listed companies. It's a joke. It really is a joke. Unfortunately, the corruption extends to the highest level of government, and I include our Prime Minister himself. He's acted on behalf of some of these companies.
Well, could you elaborate?
Of course. What I did was, by uncovering the structures of virtual oil, gas, and mining companies, I came across specifically a company called Cairn Energy, and it had a subsidiary called Cairn India. And the person that was the profile person was a guy called Sir William Benjamin Bowring Gammell. And this gentleman was a top Tory funder, the Conservative Party, and David Cameron.
Just by the sound of his name, he sounds like a tosspot.
Well, 100%.
And, you know, in this industry, some things are exactly as they seem. All right, sorry, continue.
Yeah, so what they did was, there was a company in India called Vedanta Resources. And Vedanta Resources wished to purchase a tract of sea where it was said that there were billions of barrels of oil underneath that grid reference. But this is a hearsay. This is said to be by drilling 3D graph results on various drill sites. And so I think it was about 16 billion changed hands. Unbeknown to the general public was that I uncovered that there were common directors between Vedanta Resources and a Cairn Energy subsidiary. Because when you say Cairn Energy and Cairn India, very few people would look, but there were about 80 different subsidiaries. And what I did was I tracked them all, and I found that there was a common director for Cairn Energy with who was also on the board of directors of Vedanta. And so that's insider dealing, if you understand what that is. That if you know and you transfer money between one company and another, and you have a same common director on both boards, that's insider dealing. And so I made sure that some of my material went by way of somebody with close input into the Indian government, I am told. And apparently my sort of research work ended up on the Indian Prime Minister's desk. And shortly after, he resigned.
Because he was on the take.
Well, I don't think he was on the take. I think he purely had the best interests of the Indian people, because they're two different sides of living in India. There's the accepted sect and there's the lower sect. So these business people who represent the elite in India work with the elite in the United Kingdom and elsewhere. And they'd set up this deal, of which David Cameron went to pressurize the Indian government to accept this financial deal. And not only the Cairn India, Cairn Energy and Vedanta deal, he also went to pressurize the Indian government to drop the $2 billion tax bill against Vodafone. Now, you're talking the top cellular phone network in the United Kingdom, probably the world.
That's funny, because that reminds me of what happened in New Zealand. We had Stephen Joyce, the CEO of MediaWorks, the largest private-owned media conglomerate in New Zealand, go stand for the ruling government and becomes their communications minister. And in his first act of parliament, he bailed out his old company, which he was running into the ground, $40 million of unpaid government broadcasting fees. So
that's right.
The exact that's same thing.
Espionage.
Fractal corporate scumbaggery. Espionage.
That's right. So the other company, being Vodafone, fell into my research because of two connected directors, board directors. One was a guy called Sir Samuel Essen-Jonah, and the other was a lady called Miss Anne Laverone. She resigned last year. And I know why. Was because I've been dealing for about 3 years with French-Swiss investigators who contacted me for my research work in regards to a $2.5 billion fraud between Areva Nuclear France and a company called Uramin Inc. in Namibia. And the Uramin Inc. directors included Samuel Essen-Jonah, who sold a care and maintenance uranium mine, which they'd purchased 6 months prior to for $100,000, to Areva Nuclear and Miss Anne Laverone for $2.5 billion. That was nice. That's what you call a hell of a markup. Well, the French investigators contacted me and they challenged this deal, which my material, I am told, in correspondence with these investigators, is currently before French prosecutors. And it just so happens that Miss Anne Laverone and Sir Samuel Essen-Jonah are on the board of Vodafone, to which David Cameron went to India to pressurize the Indian government to drop the $2 billion tax debt to the Indian people. Amazing, isn't it?
Oh, what a tangled web we weave.
Exactly.
What's the consequences, though? I mean, like, you're going to have a conglomerate. And we're coming to break just now, Gordon, so I'll just finish up this thought. Yes. We're dealing with a conglomerate, and I think it's like in the movie Shooter, where he says that this conglomerate exists and continues to exist because none of the members of it betray their code, their creed of money and power. And if they do, there's going to be a lot of consequences for them indeed. Gordon Bowden is my guest. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being enslaved and exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? And my very special guest is Gordon Bowden, coming at us from the Uber Kingdom. Gordon, welcome back. I'd like to get your response to my statement of the last segment about the consequences of what happens. Have any part of this network tried to expose it, tried to speak out, and then mysteriously, for some reason, kill themselves by shooting themselves in the head 6 times with a nail gun, and then 6 times on the other side of the head with a nail gun?
Well, unfortunately, I would like to see those in Parliament, in our Parliament, take a long walk off a short pier. But what's happened is that there are 56 members of Parliament that are no longer going to apply for their constituency MP or fight for their seat, which to me is a good sign, because a lot of those are the people that I have named by way of articles in internet publications. And so I know I'm hurting the people in the right place. But they will all be accountable later if anybody wants to take this challenge up, if we've got one decent, innocent, caring police officer and a financial accountant and auditor because we could recover from the library of forensic evidence that I have a couple of hundred billion, because I know where it went. I know how the transfers were made, who the individuals are that took the money, and where it's been held, in which location. And all it needs is to go and recover it. And that would save our National Health Service, the police, the armed forces, and old age pensioners, their health care for the next 200,000 years. But it takes honest people. And until my country gets together and understands what I'm doing can all be proven in a court of law. But I still hold the same views for people in Australia and New Zealand. You have a place very close to you, Fiji Islands, where I uncovered the same scumbags who are running the Vatukoula gold mine, which delisted from our stock exchange, where there's a massive story to that. It's nothing more than an elaborate fraud, where the miners of Fiji, Vatukoula, have been taken for, well, their lives have been destroyed by con artists, and Australian con artists. And how they've allowed this to carry on, the politicians in Australia, I just can't see it. They've allowed human beings in Fiji, the old the miners who went on strike for their pension, who were cast off and are still living there, I believe, from my last time that I spoke to the Red Cross regarding their conditions that they're living in. And yet standing around them are a bunch of con artists who have asset stripped their pension funds. There's no money there for the rehabilitation of the land. And these people are the people that need to be brought to justice, not by the United Kingdom, although it's a Commonwealth country, is that the Australian government should stand up and bring these people to book. And if they don't, what they are allowing is they're allowing not just the Vatukoula gold mine, but all the companies that those directors are running as Ponzi scams, and up to 50 to 60 different Ponzi scams all over the world. And well, that's
making it so complex that unless somebody's actually really, really determined to find out the truth, nobody will. We'll just stumble across it by accident.
Well, it's not that. Is it, as I said, it's like an uncovering veneer layer by layer to understand that this is not just a one or two directors that are extracting the urine. These people, this is industrial organized crime. And it doesn't take a 10-year-old to be able to dismantle one of these companies. It's that when you look at the network size, it goes beyond belief that this is being allowed and has been allowed to run for over 40 years in my books. And that's how they become so proficient at it. And that's why it's such an extended web, that when you dismantle one, you find out exactly how it works. And then it's repeated time and time again by the same people.
Do you know when this started? Like when this organization was founded?
I traced the founding sections to Barrick Gold Corporation, which was then fronted by Mohammed Adnan Khashoggi and Bush, George Bush. They were the advisors, along with the CIA, to set up massive money laundering networks, which included the Iran-Contra money laundering mechanisms. And so a lot of the backtracking led me to Barrick Gold Corporation and its senior board of directors. It's horrendous when you think of politicians who are, through greed, destroy sovereign countries and their infrastructure. Speaking, and as a member of the forces, that's where my bile built up.
Speaking of which, I've been led to believe that you actually have a lot of information about the involvement in New Zealand of this kind of scam.
Well, they will be operating in New Zealand, Australia, South America, North America, Canada. This is a transcontinental organized crime syndicate, mainly funding the elite networks and politicians. And some of the companies I've traced where they are actually funding the old regime in Afghanistan by moving money through corporate boiler rooms in London to those politicians, who then become the sort of groomed politicians to help in the opiate trades, which then brings in HSBC Bank structuring the money laundering for the drugs cartels.
I think there's a book called Totalitaria written by, I'd probably say New Zealand's best independent journalist, Ian Wishart. And he explained it like this. It's like a shark feeding frenzy. Every shark has its own motivations and its own desires, but they all happen to have the same target. Us.
Well, yeah, well, when you say us, distraction is an amazing tool that the population of the United Kingdom are split. When you're talking about the various political parties, they have a power base with the Conservatives, which are normally the higher paid earner, who especially within the stock markets and the banking fraternity, who are the people that throw vast amount of money at them, and that's to ensure that their organized crime is allowed to carry on. And you could say the same with Australia. I mean, I did the more in-depth uncovering of UI Energy, which was a South Korean entity company that was set up by some real corrupt people, South Koreans, which had the exploration rights for northern Iraq shortly after the Iraq War, where even in the United Kingdom, it was well published in the major media that one of the advisors was Tony Blair. The other advisor was Bob Hawke from Australia and George Bush's administrators. So you're saying that the war in Iraq wasn't about oil? Please. It's a joke.
Yeah, again.
It's a joke.
Apply cynicism. Thoroughly, and the truth will come out.
Well, that's what I said. Is that this is not hearsay. This is documented fact. And these are the people that are making millions of pounds by going around giving public speeches. These people should have borrowed the rope that they stuck around Saddam's neck. And that's as a serviceman. I said. I often look at the concrete plinths, rows and rows of them. Innocent people, artists, poets, engineers, you know. And I think, for what? For what? For individuals' common greed? No, there's something that we need to change in this this world. I'm just having a little go using what sort of expertise I have, is to uncover the filth that's in my country, never mind New Zealand and Australia.
Well,
people must pick it up.
The structure, as you've exposed, it's kind of like if you topple one, all the rest of the dominoes will fall. Would be my assessment of the situation. All you need is that first one to fall. You need that first big case, those first big criminals to go behind bars, criminals with big names, recognizable names. Imagine Tony Blair going to jail. Finally, like a few years ago, he came to New Zealand, ASB Sports Park, right? And myself and a number of other activists were trying to initiate a citizen's arrest outside. But unfortunately, there were just way, 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 way too many cops to get past.
That's right. I said that Tony Blair, from my understanding, had the information that could have brought the Conservative government down in the United Kingdom. And that concerned three missing battlefield-ready gravity-drop nuclear weapons that were stolen. They were Tory purchased and lost in Oman. They were to be used for the retake of Kuwait if Saddam used chemicals or bioagents against the coalition forces. And they disappeared out of their storage containers, 20-foot ISO containers, in a transport yard in Oman, and disappeared.
Oh, no.
And the documents that I've been given by a whistleblower to me, which is well documented, which is part of the speech I gave on the steps of Trafalgar Square. Yes, and unfortunately for the major media, they won't pick it up, because if they do, it will be the start of Pandora's box.
Yeah. And probably the end of the career of said journalist who has the gusto to actually do it.
Well, as I said, is that when you start to look at I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, you're talking about the Murdoch control of most of the media. And then if you looked at the BBC, I implicated the BBC in covering up a lot of this themselves when I was invited into the BBC. I showed them the documents which listed companies like Russia Today and Press TV, which is supposed to be run by Iranian intelligence services. But it's not. When you see the founding agents, it's actually run by Mossad out of a network of London Finchley Road addresses.
Sweet mercy.
It's a joke. It's a joke.
Well, and in that case, I've got a couple of friends who go on Press TV that I'm going to have to share this interview with in that case. Freaking God, it's so annoying. You grow up and you think the world is one way, and there's so many different elements in it, and it's such a complicated world in itself, and then you find out that each of every single understanding you've ever come to in your entire freaking existence turns out to be a lie, and you have to start from scratch all again like a newborn baby to come up to speed with how things truly are.
That's what I did in 2001. I physically was sick. When I found out I saw the documents myself, I became physically sick reading it, because the evidence was all there. It was all forensic evidence. And when I was escorted in by one of the top executives of the BBC through those barricades, when I showed him some of the corporate registrations for Russia Today TV and Press TV, he stood back in amazement and said, "I'm just going to take these documents to one of my producers." And he came back and he said, "What else?" And I said, "Well, Palestine Telegraph, they come out the same address, which is 788 790 Finchley Road." And I said, "So do hundreds more. Small radio stations that are supposedly independent radio stations, they all come out of that same Finchley Road address, which is being run by Israelis." I said, "So you go."
Do you think it's there's actually any national boundaries and borders anymore, or do you think the intel community is running the globe now, basically?
Well, even we're on a system called Skype, and because I was warned by South African police inspectors that my mail was being diverted and observed and copied and posted elsewhere because I was too close to a lot of the establishment, was that I noticed that on my one laptop I had McAfee had been put on there. I didn't put it on. And, you know, McAfee is part of Skype and Gmail. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Well, there you are.
Mm-hmm. You can't make the stuff
and
up.
And I know because of my service career, even although I came out in 1982, is that they use social media sites for GCHQ.
Yeah, I would assume so. And we're coming to break now, Gordon. We'll come back in just a few minutes. When we do, I want to really think about the personal consequences of actually doing this research you did. You said you got physically ill. I want to expand on that when we come back. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 4 days a week for your listening pleasure. Bear in mind, I am not a credible journalist. I'm an incredible journalist. So don't listen to this show speaking thinking that I'm going to give you this fact-based, unbelievably great information or whatever. That's the guest's job. I'm here to make sure that it's fun, because ultimately researching into things, especially the darker sectors of society, can be inherently stressful and painful. And as far as I know, there aren't too many people who are talking about the stressful, painful stuff and making terrible jokes about it at the same time. My very special guest is Gordon Bowden. Now, Gordon, I wanted you to sort of elaborate, because you said you got physically ill when you first discovered this. I wonder what other consequences you've had, because the amount of activists I've talked to have exposed things they family, jobs, careers, assets, all kind of goes into disarray a lot of the time.
Yeah, that's correct. But my main stomach-churning sickness was from my inner gut when I saw the paperwork of who was involved, especially at the time when I saw the file on Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, and her son being entertained by one of the main suspects in my partner's fraud. And shortly thereafter, as I said, the Equatorial Guinea coup occurred, because the other people involved who were wining and dining our Iron Lady were part of Executive Outcomes, who were part of the same private military company aiding and assisting Simon Mann and his cohorts. I think they were from 38 Battalion, the mercenaries that were part of the Equatorial Guinea coup. And so I could understand how they would steal from little people in elaborate frauds and then use not even their own money to perpetrate massive corporate raids on foreign sovereign-based territory.
And the technical term for that is being a guinea fowl.
Yeah, well, as I said, my stomach was churning when I the very people that I put a uniform on for, who sent me to far distant lands no matter where I went in the Royal Air Force, was to understand the level of corruption and how high it went. And these are the people with supposedly trust, honor, and integrity. Prime Minister. So that's when I say, not as if it's carried on. I said, I was then determined in the public interest and as a duty of care is to follow where it took me. And it hasn't been all-consuming in my life. I still had to live my life with my partner and struggle a bit, because whatever little bit of money that we've had available goes for printing in ink and portable hard drives, flash drives. And so I've built up a library as great interest, and that library has proved me to be correct 100% every single time to the accusations that I've made against those right honourable members of Parliament, members of the House of Lords. They're all, say, peas in the same pod. And that's where I believe people in the United Kingdom have been misled by those very people who in a few short weeks will stand before the people and say, vote for me. And all I can see is filth.
What was your initial motivation to join the military, and how much disillusionment was there to realize what's going on?
Well, I was motivated. I came from a very small town in South Wales. I was quite good with mechanics even as a young boy, but you know, dismantling things and being able to place them out and then put them back together, you know, motorbikes and things like that. However, I wanted to escape a family environment which I wasn't quite happy with as a young boy. young man. And I saw this as an ideal way to move forward in a highly professional trade and serve my country. That's why I joined. And throughout my service career, I worked with some of the most complex, high-valued assets that the military had. Gas turbine engines, hydraulic systems, radar systems, you name it. If it was in engineering, I did it. And so I had a great joy and challenge to understand high-volume air conditioning, refrigeration systems, ground radar, ground-to-air missile systems. It all became a learning curve throughout my 12 years within the military. But I got disillusioned a few times when I went on detachments in the Persian Gulf. And I often wondered why we were in places like Sharjah and Mazira in the Gulf, looking after the assets of some foreign sheikh and protecting him as opposed to a Commonwealth land, if you understand. Is that some of the bases like Sharjah and Mazira were in the United Arab Emirates. And I didn't think that the people that were jumping over the fence, stealing rockets off the wing pylons, wearing flip-flops, represented much of a technical threat to the masses of military might that we had. So, you know, I said I had my own thoughts later on to when I decided to finish my military career, having served my 12-year service contract. But I'd say I was disillusioned a few times, but the professional manner in which I served with those that I served with was second to none. I mean, the Americans I worked with and the Australians I worked with, best in the world. It became my family. So I couldn't knock that. However, that doesn't take away the political side of a military force.
You were,
and I
there,
wasn't quite happy.
You were in there for 12 years.
Yes.
How many years into it did you start wondering who you were really working for?
I think I joined up in 1969, and then in 1973, while serving at 103 MU in Cyprus, we did a lot of the Far East detachments to the Persian Gulf. And I think then I looked as a young man and looked at what were we doing there, you know, in the Persian Gulf. And I often thought that this was purely about oil and protecting regimes who were supplying oil to the United Kingdom. But that was my own belief in what I saw. But as I said, we were very professional. I think possibly the best trained in the world, the Royal Air Force. I met a lot of Americans, and trust me, they weren't as dedicated as we were, even with the equipment that they had and what we had. But we were still, I would say, 10 times better than their professionalism. But as I said, I kept myself, I'm a bit of a loner, and I kept myself until I decided to come out in 1981, midway through. I was offered to sign for 22 years, and I said, no, I said, my children are not going to go to boarding school, and I decided to come out and finish it when my 12 years was up.
And that's when you started going into mining, South Africa, that kind of thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, they offered a sort of pre-release applications to various institutions. You put your CV out on the big World Wide Web, and I was approached by Goldfields. I had three opportunities. I could have gone to Australia or New Zealand. I was offered a job there. I was offered a job to join the South African Defence Force, their Air Force, and go up four higher ranks. But I'd had enough of working in a suit, albeit a blue one. And I chose mining as a different career because the challenge is to work at 3.5 kilometers below the ground, hard rock mining. You know, there were 27,000 staff then, so a massive operation with different engineering sort of parameters, which I loved. I love a challenge. And this is no different what I'm doing now. It's just dismantling corporate espionage and their companies, much the same as I would do a gas turbine engine.
Mm.
Once you know which each part plays, whether it's the directors, accountants, auditors, and lawyers, once you understand the mechanisms to dismantle their boiler rooms was very easy.
And having the experience being 3 kilometres underground, you probably have you wouldn't have too much of a hard time going into really, really dark places like that, huh?
Yeah, and very, very dangerous places as well underground, very dangerous. Yeah, I saw a lot of accidents underground, and you do. They're a different breed than miners, especially the South African hard rock miners, because you're working extreme pressures, temperatures, very high humidity, 96% humidity. So unless you add air conditioning and bulk water chilling, there's no way that you could work at those depths, 3.5 kilometers underground. You're looking at a rock surface temperature of about 40 degrees Celsius. And unless you had the high-volume air conditioning, they could never work at those depths. And they've gone even deeper after I left. So, as I said, I work with some very brave tribal people who love me as a brother, and I would have died for them as well. Yeah, different beast.
What made you leave the mining industry?
Oh, we had a bad accident. I just worked about 18 hours with a team of 20-odd doing the cooling tower fans, descaling the blades. After we finished this, like a triple shift, I had a team which got in the cage. There were 120 people in the cage, 3 decks, 40 per deck. I was in the middle deck with my team, and we were coming out, and they were doing work on the rock winder where they disengaged the drive and put sleepers in and sprags, wedges, after they declutched the two winder drums, where there were two skips, two 18-ton skips, which were equally at the same level in mid-shafts, and one must have had about 5 ton of rock in it. And as they declutched the drive away from the gearbox mechanism, the one with the rock in ran away. And the team that were working on it, they couldn't put sprags in and stop it running away. And it, while I was traveling at 12 meters a second with 119 other people, this skip came screaming past us, bringing the cable with it, which then pulled out of the drum, and then brought all the buntings, steel cables, water pipes, slurry pipes, all down on top of us while we were traveling at 12 meters a second. We then, one of the pipes punched a hole in the top deck, and then the screams were horrendous from the 40 in the top deck, and they were peeing on me and pooping on me. And for, I think it was about 14, 16 hours, we were trapped in this cage. When it came to an emergency stop, you don't just stop where there's 120 people in it. It bounces, and it bounces like 50, 60 meters up, and then bounces 50, 60 meters down. And all the time, these people were screaming in the cage. So quite an unpleasant experience. And then I decided I'd like to see the sun for a while. And so I then was immediately taken in by the University of Transkei, which was a good change.
What did you do at the university?
A facilities engineer. I did all the service center, central plant refrigeration system, and bulk chill water, centrifugal chiller, and reciprocating chillers, all the air conditioning throughout the university, all the scientific labs, the medical facility, the cold storage rooms for the bodies, and some of the scientific machinery that they had on the university, which was a top grade university, 5,500 students, with their hostels and sports stadium. So, you know, say another variation in engineering.
Gordon, we're coming to break just now. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, in just a few minutes. Don't you go anywhere, folks. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It is now the final segment with the illustrious Gordon Bowden. Has anybody ever called you illustrious before? I hope I'm the first.
No, never. I think you're the first.
Damn, I'm good. I'm just thinking about this. What was I thinking about this morning? I was thinking about my elders, right? And how many people I've talked to who are older, wiser, more experienced, have technical skills in a lot of areas. And I was just thinking how grateful I am that as a young man, people like yourself have been willing to share their experiences, share their knowledge. Do you feel... As you're getting later on in life, that's kind of a larger part of what it is, not having new experiences so much as it is sharing older ones with the youth?
Well, I did as a non-commissioned officer in the Royal Air Force. You then move away from being hands-on to training junior airmen and supervising and taking responsibility for their forward movement throughout the Air Force. And I took great joy. I trained a lot of the Australian contingents who came to Cyprus in TACAN radar, AR-1, PAR radar. And so you have a greater understanding of what you were like as a junior airman, and to have somebody take somebody under your wing and look after them and see them progress through the ranks. So it's everything is knowledge and understanding how you can assist others in a little bit of knowledge. And that's what I'm trying to do here in the United Kingdom is plant seeds to the people that understand what I'm trying to get across, is that there's an evil within my own country which needs to be put right, so that one day all our people, all our children and grandchildren, they'll have a more responsible, accountable government. And I'm sure you would say the same for yours.
True. Although a less powerful, not so overbearing government would be nice as well, especially if they outlawed income tax, which just goes to pay the interest on the debt to the criminal bankers who just make the debt up off the top of their head. I was asked to pose a question to you or ask you to explain a particular individual by the name of David Anthony Lenegas. Who's that?
Well, hell of a character. He's an Australian. And I've been dealing with one of the contacts to me was his brother, Lucas Lenegas, and a man after my own heart. He's a hands-on engineer, ex-marine engineer, who's been having quite a hard time with his illustrious brother, who I believe was recruited by an MI5 spoof called Don Strang. That's Donald Ian Layman Strang, who brought him into the United Kingdom, fixed up his passports and his visa to get him into the UK, and then started running Lonro, a name which would make a lot of people straighten up, because that was the sort of tiny Roland's Empire German guy. So Mr. Lenegas, yes. Nasty piece of work. He and I have had many words over the years, and I've accused all his companies of being nothing more, nothing less than massive Ponzi scams that are there to asset strip their companies and move vast amount of money.
Well, I bet he didn't like that.
Pardon?
I bet he didn't like that.
He didn't like it today. But I don't mind because I've got some letters that, should they decide to take me to court, it's lovely that you can introduce them as N265 full disclosure documents in a court of law. And I don't think David would like that, not given the correspondence I have from his brother, who was kind enough to send me some documents, which I forwarded on to various institutional authorities. And I'm looking forward for a bit of action. I love it.
I always find it interesting, the word documents, it strikes fear into the heart of a lot of people. Oh my God, this guy's got documents.
It should do. Because what David's brother gave me was the sort of corporate entities which had been structured up in Australia for moving money from the United Kingdom companies to these companies set up in Australia to pay wives' accounts and children's accounts, ex-wives. And so that's what you call fraud, theft, and money laundering from public listed companies. And so I say, things are happening, I know, because I follow various stock exchange companies' daily movement of shares and the comments of investors on these bulletin boards for their companies. And trust me, there's trouble at mill, as they would say in Yorkshire.
Do you think that you'll get a resolution to this anytime soon?
Well, I don't think the people are so stupid and thick that eventually the set of dominoes will start to collapse. And all it takes is one or two. And I've challenged quite a few in the last 3 or 4 years, and I've watched them dissolve. Now, I don't know how thick our authorities are, but they can only run and hide for so long, and then they've got to face the music. And I believe that when these systems start to collapse, like the Vatukoula gold mine, that's delisted from the alternative investment market, they will be accountable. I mean, the Red Cross don't work with these striking miners who were poor, disheveled Fijians who, say, have been treated like cast-offs, that eventually this story will get out and those people will go to jail. And it can't happen soon enough for myself, as being an ex-miner, you understand?
Yeah.
Is that when you understand that the hardships that these Fijian miners go through, to have been lied to and conned, whereby that they've just been thrown on the scrap heap by a bunch of con artists. Because I know with the documents I have, there was a program which came out in 2008 in Australia, and it was an expose of over $1 billion fraud called ABC Four Corners, Bad Company. And in 2008, they did an expose on the corporate asset stripping of a company called Johannesburg Consolidated Investments and Rudaport Deep Gold and Randburg Resources. And these companies were asset stripped to the tune of over $1 billion. And that's where our mate, David Anthony Lenigas, a famous Australian, I call him Ned Kelly, and I think it goes down quite well for what he is. But he was groomed, and he was groomed by people like Don Strang, who I'm told is a MI5, to facilitate this organized crime syndicate, which operates jointly between Australia, Canada, and the United Kingdom, and South Africa.
So are there any subpoenas or affidavits or things like that being filed in order to...
Well,
hold on one second. In New Zealand, we just had a former mayor of Auckland and a 33rd degree Freemason, John Banks, be privately prosecuted by a litigant named Graham McCready. And because of that private prosecute, nobody else would actually take up the corruption cause or anything like that. So somebody actually had to take personal responsibility in order to take this guy to court, and he won. Do you think that might be a better way, or do you believe that the authorities and the justice system haven't been so corrupted as to be completely incapable of delivering justice in this instance?
Oh, I think eventually what happens is that you get groups of investors who complain to the various authorities, that is the Market Abuse and the Serious Fraud Office, that these things cannot go hidden time and time again without there being some consequences, and eventually it will start to topple. And I've always said that all it takes is one or two small insights into these massive networks, that once one goes, they will all topple. That's my belief, because you can't hide company after company with the same directors asset stripping each company without there being mass revolt. And once that's where it's going to come.
It's been blown public, once the cat's out of the bag, they can't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And exactly. That's ultimately the goal. Gordon Bowden has been my very special guest, ladies and gentlemen. We're just ending the show now. I want to thank you very much for your service to humanity, just in a very general way, and your incredible experiences and life has actually been a really nice experience to just sit here and absorb. So, Gordon, thank you very much, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening in to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast, and one of my principal sponsors, who was gifting $100 a month, stopped donating just recently, so we'd need to make that up somehow. So if anybody out there wants to start donating a few dollars a month in order to keep us on the air, keep this operation going, we so much appreciate that. There are PayPal and KiwiBank options on the homepage of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We'll see you again sometime.